I'm Dr. David Malbranche, Senior Director of Global HIV Medical Affairs at Gilead Sciences.
I am Dr. Christopher Chauncey Watson, Global Marketing Director at Gilead Sciences.
Welcome to Zero Hour, a podcast brought to you by Gilead Sciences, where we will be speaking with leading health and culture experts to understand the barriers that keep global populations from meaningful, transformative care. We'll shed light on inequities, we'll celebrate innovation, and together, we'll imagine a world with zero barriers, zero disparities, zero new infections, and zero people left behind. It's possible, but there's zero time to wait. Do you remember lying in bed when you were a kid, and before falling asleep, imagining what you'd be when you were older? A firefighter, maybe. A musician? The president. Every kid dreams of being something great, a leader of some kind, a hero. Well, what if they didn't have to wait until they were grown-ups to become heroes? What if young people, right now, could save lives and transform the future just by talking about HIV? Today's guests are proof that young people can use their voices to combat HIV stigma, encourage prevention, and help end the epidemic once and for all.
Welcome to another episode of Zero Hour, a podcast brought to you by Gilead Sciences. This podcast is intended to be a safe space for open conversations on global perspectives related to HIV, health, and health equity. Both of our guests today have dedicated their lives to educating young people about HIV. Our first guest, Ashley Murphy, is a remarkable young woman who has overcome seemingly insurmountable odds. As a National Youth Ambassador for the Canadian Foundation for AIDS Research, Ashley has shared her personal story of living with HIV. In addition to her 2015 TED Talk, which she gave at the age of 16, Ashley has spoken at the United Nations AIDS Gala in Geneva, Switzerland, and to the UN General Assembly in New York, raising HIV and AIDS awareness around the world. Our second guest, Leslie Hall, lives his values both professionally and personally, with a deep commitment to the liberation of marginalized people. In his role as the director of Historically Black Colleges and Universities Program at the Human Rights Campaign Foundation, Leslie works with HBCU leaders to achieve full LGBTQIA+ equality through collective action and leadership development. Let's start with you, Ashley, and welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Ashley, when did you learn you were living with HIV?
So where do I begin? Well, my story starts at birth. I was born in Toronto, Canada, to a mother who was an addict and an alcoholic. And even though she loved me, her addictions made it impossible for her to care for me. When I was first born, I was still in her care, which was very surprising considering my older three siblings had been taken out of her care. I went home with her for the first few weeks. And then Children's Aid, which is the Canadian equivalent to Child Protective Services, they did a surprise home inspection. And they saw that there was no formula anywhere to be found. I wasn't being fed. My crib was being held together by duct tape. Like the place was just in complete disarray. And so they took me out of that house immediately and put me into foster care for a couple of weeks. And during that time, I was still able to do, regular visits with my birth mother, supervised, of course. And it was at one of these visits that I went into cardiac arrest. I stopped breathing. The doctors, they did an x-ray. They found that all four lobes of my lungs were filled with PC pneumonia, a type of pneumonia seen in those with compromised immune systems. And I was only 6 weeks old at the time. And so they're kind of scratching their heads being like, what is wrong with this girl? Like, we have no idea. So they brought my birth mother to the hospital and they did a blood test on her and myself. And both tests came back with full-blown AIDS. So at that moment, because they knew that my body was so fragile, they decided to put me into a medically induced coma for 3.5 months. So Children's Aid started looking for a foster family that would take me. And I think it's really important to note that they had originally called the person who had taken care of me for those few weeks, but she didn't know of my status, obviously. And once she found out about my HIV, she wanted nothing to do with me. And so they kept calling parents, met with so many no's. until my mother, Carrie Murphy, she was the brave woman to say yes. And I think it was amazing because she said yes without even consulting my father. So she rushed down to SickKids that day, picked me up, grabbed me, took me home. And my mother's a very spiritual person. And so she said when she walked through that door that day, it was like this force coming over her, whether it was God or whatever. She knew that this little girl, she's going to make it. I just think, like, I get goosebumps whenever I share that story just because, like, she knew I could do it before I could. She was my advocate before I became my own advocate. That's the reason why I'm here today, because my parents, they cared for me. They loved me despite my HIV diagnosis. They were like, how can we help this girl? And so Children's Aid, when they called my mom, they said, well, she has about a month to live. I don't even know sometimes how my mom did it, just that bravery and courage. She was like, whether it's a month, a year, 5 years, we're going to love her forever. And so I right away was always so supported by my family. My parents have been foster parents since 1995, taking in children with all varying different disabilities. And so I think because of that and because of my siblings, seeing them being told, oh, you can't do this for X amount of reasons, they're like, well, let me show you. Let me show you that I can. And so I really learned from my older siblings, especially. Someone could tell you one thing, doesn't mean you have to believe it. As long as you believe in yourself, you can do it. And that was really the driving force that started my advocacy career. I was sat down when I was 7 years old by my parents, and they said, you know, Ashley, the reason you take all these medications and you go to all these doctor's appointments, it's because you have a virus called HIV. And at the time, I was like, okay, mom, so what's for dinner? When they told me that, they were like, you can't tell anybody. And I was like, what do you mean I can't tell anybody? And I flipped the script on them a little bit because my parents have always taught me to be an open and honest individual. And I was like, but I feel like I'm telling a lie or like I'm keeping something. Because even though HIV isn't all of me, it does make up a big part of me and my story. And so I just started telling everybody. Whether it was like a grocery clerk, I'd be like, hi, my name's Ashley, I have HIV. At the schoolyard, growing up in the Catholic system, a lot of parents tried to get me kicked out of my school. But I had my principal at the time that said, you know what? If you don't want Ashley to be here, take your kids out of the school because she's staying.
What other forms of support did you have growing up? It sounded like there were almost like angels being placed in front of you along that path of the journey. What other kind of support did you receive?
So I'm very, very privileged and lucky to have had the support I did as a child because I feel like that is where I truly learned to find my voice. And that's when I learned a lot of my peers were voiceless and they felt silenced because of the stigma and discrimination that they were facing in their communities. So when my parents sat me down, they told me about my status. That summer, I ended up going to a camp in Canada for kids who were either infected or affected by HIV. This is really where my journey started. Unfortunately, a lot of my peers were bullied in their schools due to their HIV status. They would share stories about, I've been having pencils thrown at me in the classroom because of my status. Honestly, I realized the most ignorant people growing up were the parents. The kids did not care. I had troubles growing up because of that, yeah. Going to sleepovers and then one parent contacting the other and being like, are you sure you want to have Ashley over? Just the fear of just like being around someone with HIV. And that's when I realized there are so many misconceptions from a toilet seat, sharing a water bottle, hugging somebody, kissing somebody. And it's unfortunate. It really is. And so as an advocate, I've really just tried to be as open and honest with people and really giving them the facts. And people have asked me some ignorant questions, but I feel like it's all a part of their learning process. And I've always said, had I not been born with HIV, I really don't think I'd be as educated about it as I am because it's just not talked about. In schools, it's super scathed over. They're like, okay, this is what an STI is. Next. Like, it really wasn't something that was talked about. I mean, knowledge is power. Absolutely.
What is giving you the motivation to just show up for yourself every day?
When I was first told about my status, and like I said, I didn't really understand it. But then the more research I was doing and the more questions I asked, I started getting really upset for a few years, angry at the world, angry at my birth mother. And I was like, why do I have HIV? Like, why me? Like throwing myself a pity party. And my mother, she sat me down. She was like, okay, none of this negativity. I don't like to hear this. And she said, you know, people like your mom, when they don't get the help they need, they dig a hole for themselves that's too deep for them to get out of. Having people in your corner is really, really important. But it's so hard on the hard days when you're like, oh yeah, love yourself. When you feel awful. And then sometimes you feel a bit fraudulent because you're talking about a message that you may not necessarily adhere to that day. A common thread that I've seen amongst a lot of my advocacy friends and just the HIV community in general is that a lot of them didn't feel like they deserve to be loved. And I can attest to that. I felt that for a very long time. I didn't feel like I was deserving enough to have love, to be loved, to find love. Because like I asked my mom so many times growing up, do you think I'll be able to have kids? Do you think I'll be able to get married? Do you think I'll be able to go to university? Like these are just things I didn't think were possible. Most people think it's possible. But for me, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to live to see that. But every single time my mom was like, yes, you were going to go to university. Yes, you were going to have babies. Yes, you were going to find a husband.
Thank you for telling that story and being so vulnerable, because I know you've told it many times and it seems like it would almost be like ripping a scab off a wound sometimes to tell that story again. One of the things that I've always told people, and I've worked in different spaces and had to diagnose people living with HIV, and they always think when they come in, when you find out you're living with HIV, that you have to tell the world. And I often tell people, just tell one person, at least one person that can be in your corner. And it doesn't necessarily have to be another person who's living with HIV, but it may be someone that really can empathize and just support you for who you are. Can you talk about what it's like taking HIV medications today and how it's changed from, say, when you first had your diagnosis and you were growing up?
Right now, I would definitely say that I'm the healthiest I've ever been. I've been undetectable for more than half of my life now. And it is because of these medications.
How did you learn to take care of yourself while living with HIV?
I've noticed as I've grown up and everything, one of the big things that I'm probably the most secure about is my HIV status. Because I've kind of learned in my 25 years, hey, if you don't like it, you can kindly or unkindly fuck off. And like my mom always told me that like there are going to be people that are going to say negative things.
Yeah.
But those are the people you don't want in your life anyway.
We do have another guest at this table, and I want to acknowledge that Leslie is here. And Leslie, why do you care so deeply about the work you do?
Why do I care so much? So I think my kind of care and concern really kind of centered around my privilege. You know, my story starts actually with a praying grandmother in a Black family, a Black Roman Catholic family. No, my family is loving. I don't have the same types of stories that a lot of other folks have. And so I went to two HBCUs, Bowie State University and Howard University. The culture wasn't as toxic as it is in the South. And so when I think about why I do this work, particularly leading the HBCU work at HRC and in LGBTQ rights, it's because I didn't have that. And I want to do as much as I can to eliminate that for others. I would tell my students all the time that we all have a debt to pay. We are all living on the graces and prayers of somebody else. We didn't earn it. And so we have to do what we can do to make life better for others.
You know, when we think about historically Black colleges and universities or HBCUs, why is HIV and sexual education so critically important to that?
You know, I think we should start about just the significance and relevance. Black colleges are just incredibly important to the American society. There hasn't been any social advances for our people that has not involved HBCUs. When you think about the HIV epidemic and what it has done, particularly in the Black and brown communities, you can't help but to think that it is a civil rights issue of today. And it is also a significant health equity issue. The question I would then say is, why not HBCUs? Like, we should be the leaders in this. And so when you look at where the epidemic lives, which is in the American South, and you look at where the majority of historically Black colleges and universities are, and you look at students that are, you know, going to these colleges that are 70-80% Pell Grant eligible, that means, you know, you would only suspect that these students are coming from areas where healthcare is not a quality or of a premium. And so we have students that are leaving areas of, let's just say, resource deserts and going to campuses that are resource deserts. That is not helping us eliminate HIV. And so the first thing that I feel like was important for us to do at HBCUs was tell the story of like where we are. We have to talk about it. There are some HBCU campuses in 2023 that still don't even believe their students are freaking on campus. They don't want to put condoms in the dorm rooms because they think that's going to encourage sex. There are campuses that are still stuck in a place where the world has passed them by. And so it's important for us to, one, bring that information to them, and two, to show them how they can lead in this area.
Can you tell us a little bit, Leslie, about the PrEP peer education program?
Sure. It addresses the issues that we found when we did a HBCU Health Center Directory index. We assessed all of the HBCU health centers with the resources that they offered, HIV testing, treatment, culturally competent counseling, and all that. And we realized that, wait, these schools are woefully under-equipped to deal with the issue at hand. And then we did a little bit more digging and we were like, okay, what is the best way to get this information out to the folks that need it, our students? And every, you know, best data point that we could find or best practice was through peer education. Students listen to other students. Not long ago that we were having an event at HRC, and I asked a group of students, you know, who should we bring as the keynote speaker? And they mentioned some folks from off of TikTok who had a huge following, like these, you know, young people who are influencers. And I was like, who are these folks? What it showed me was, one, they want to hear from folks within their own kind of generation and network. And so, the peer educator program was born, and it was really designed to address two things, public education and stigma. Peer educators are trained to deliver scientific, fact-based sex and health education on campus around PrEP and other STIs and STDs. They host programs to normalize the conversation around HIV and healthy sex to then address stigma.
How receptive were the campus health centers to this peer education program?
Believe it or not, they loved it.
Excellent.
HBCUs are under-resourced institutions, mostly because of racism. They are not funded at the same level that other institutions are funded. And so HBCUs generally put their resources where they can get the best bang for their buck. Peer educator programs are great and they have been proven to work. They're also expensive. We support our peer educators with a $1,500 stipend. We give them a budget for their campus events. Mm-hmm. We take them to conferences and we do continuous monthly professional development. And so that's not cheap. What the health centers realized was that, wait, y'all are really like a resource ad, like y'all are helping us.
Why is it so important to have these programs at HBCUs and give the resources to these health centers?
HBCUs are responsible for Black doctors, Black lawyers, Black judges, entrepreneurs, Black teachers. If we start at HBCUs, then we can, you know, use that to build impact and to expand our ability to like change the culture. HBCUs have an incredibly unique and valuable place in Black culture. There's no one part of Black culture that HBCUs have not engaged in. When you think about a place of inquiry and academic rigor and teaching and learning, those are all pieces that you need in order to be influential. And HBCUs are just a really good place to start. And these institutions are in the backyards of these, of where the virus is. And so we have to start there.
And how does an emphasis on respectability affect sexual health and HIV education among some HBCUs?
As much as I probably wear my cloak of respectability every day, it is killing us. Respectability breeds stigma. When you go to, let's just use Howard University, for instance, or Morehouse College or Spelman College, these storied institutions where first Black Supreme Court justices, first Black Vice President of the United States, that carries a weight of you know, wanting to honor that. And unfortunately, we feel like if our images aren't picture perfect, then it goes against that. When I say respectability is killing us, is there are students out there right today that know they need to go get an HIV test, that know they've been busting it down since homecoming,
right,
will not go to the health center to get that test because they don't want to be seen going to get an HIV test, or they may be just ashamed of what they know to be true for themselves. You know, students are on their moms and dads and guardians' health insurance. So if your mama see that you're going to get all these tests done or you get need treatment and things like that, that can also breed a very unsafe kind of situation. And so we need to create mechanisms and infrastructures to support young people where they can get these life-saving things without, you know, jeopardizing their safety.
Leslie, you're starting to take me into this conversation of the challenges that our youth face, right? So even if I wanted to go learn my status, I may need to disclose my sexual behaviors to my family. I may need to disclose what I'm doing. What are the additional challenges that young people face, particularly in understanding their own sexual health related to HIV?
Well, I think it all comes back to, again, lack of education. Absolutely. Like, first and foremost, like, I also, like, grew up in the Roman Catholic faith. All of these topics were, like, very hush-hush taboo. But where they really should be started, these conversations, are in the house. Obviously, it's not easy to disclose all the sexual things you're doing with your parents and everything. But I feel like having these conversations are so important to kind of break down these barriers. To say, hey, I mean, like, we all do it. So why not be smart and safe about it?
Leslie, and to you, what are the additional challenges that the youth you see and you serve are facing?
You have parents out there fighting right now so their kids won't get competent science, fact-based sex education in school because they damn sure not talking about it at home, but they don't want to get it in school.
When in fact, we are all products of two people having unprotected sex, right?
There you go.
There you go.
You know, that's part of the issue. I think another issue is misinformation, disinformation. There's a lot of it going on out there. And at this point, there are so many mediums for information or what you would consider information. Folks don't know what to believe. And I think that's also a dilemma that young people just may not have the maturity to be able to decipher. I could tell bullshit a mile away, but young people can't really do that at this point. And so they're listening to things that may not be true or may be true, but not going deeper or being critical about it. And so I feel that young people, they are on the right track. This is the most equality focused generation of our lifetimes. And so a lot of the things that the adults get hung up with, young people can care less. I was talking to somebody, a young person the other day, and they was like, they said something about being pansexual. And I was like, pansexual, what's that? I'm just learning all this. And they're like, oh, this is da-da-da-da-da-da-da. They're in high school, you know? And I'm like, damn.
But also about sexual health, because you can't talk about HIV without talking about sexual health. How would you characterize the level of awareness about HIV and sexual health among the young people that you work with?
The people that are the most educated, at least in my circle, are those who are HIV positive themselves. And it's because they had to do the research. They were really given no other option.
In your experience, in your opinion, what would you say would be the best way to bridge that gap so that for people who may not be living with HIV, that they realize how important it is to have knowledge about it?
I think through personal stories is really where you kind of like tap into it. And I think people are the most open and honest with themselves and with others when they're vulnerable. And so I think being able to have these vulnerable conversations through my work, I've gone to different universities in California, Ohio, other places. And it really is there. Like when it's coming from a youth, that's when they really start to tap into it. And that's when they start caring. Because again, there's that relatability factor.
Right.
And they're like, oh, wait, she's 25. I'm 25. Like sort of thing. But she has HIV and I don't. She's educated and I'm not. So how can I get educated?
Yeah, I think college students are a bit more aware today. One thing that I can say that I feel is a positive, is going in a positive direction, is you can't cut on Hulu or Netflix or TV without seeing an HIV commercial, or you can't help but not to engage with it at some level. And then there are a lot of innovative kind of strategies that are being implemented nowadays, where folks are being tested at the clubs and at the bathhouses, and you know all the other sorts of places that young people are frequenting. And so I feel that folks, young people, particularly college students, do have a basic sense of awareness of what it is and what are the challenges are, but they are not fully aware of all the tools at their disposal to prevent said behavior.
I've worked in a few college health centers in the United States, and that was what I found as well, was that the youth were already there. They were talking about it. They were waiting for somebody on the other end in the healthcare profession or their parents or someone else who was an older adult to actually tap into that. And so it's a very true thing that I think the youth sometimes has to drag the older generations kicking and screaming.
If your mom and dad or parent, if you have a two-parent household, they've been married for 40 years, what they need to know about PrEP for?
Right, and this is pre-exposure prophylaxis.
For real.
And give them some grace. Give them some grace.
Yeah. And so my mother's 63.
Right.
You don't need no PrEP. You know, and so I think that's why there are organizations exist like HRC and others that are filling in the gap for this. And HBCUs, they should know this. They should be one of the leaders of this. And so that's why we invest in HBCUs.
Ashley, for you being in, you know, Canada, how does the political climate influence kind of sexual health conversations among HIV, among youth and LGBTQ plus folks?
Well, there was in Canada a few years ago, when they tried to repeal the sexual health education, like that couldn't be more detrimental to youth health and safety, the education that we have. Because again, we've come so far from like 1998. So why are we taking it back there? We shouldn't be looking in the past. We have to look forward.
That's the part that worries me, honestly, particularly in this country, that we are a certain political party are making decisions not on fact or data. They're doing it off of hate. It is going to walk us back. And it's taken us so long just to get where we are now. We still have further to go. And so what I mean by that is when you look at some of the legislation that's passing now around gender-affirming care, or some states have rejected Medicaid or Medicare expansion, or you have states that are now eliminating diversity, equity, and inclusion, which has been proven to increase belonging, retention, and all other indicators for marginalized folks. Like all those programs are like the vehicle for positive sexual health education and access and prevention on campus. And so if we can't talk about LGBTQ stuff, it's very hard for us to then connect, you know, all the other social inequities that may exist. You also can't read books in some of these states about this stuff. I mean, and let's just also be very clear, them students ain't going to that damn library to get that. They're looking at TikTok and other things to get the information. But the symbolism of banning books is something that you look at, you know, Nazi Germany or something. And so if we aren't careful, and right now we in a hot pickle, if we aren't careful, we're going to find ourselves looking like a different country. And it can happen to us. There are other countries, you know, in Haiti, just a couple years ago, they stormed the president's mansion. He hot-tailed it somewhere else. And now, you know, so this stuff can happen. Oh, I forgot January 6th did happen. So they will storm the Capitol, you know? And so all this is very important, and it's all interconnected.
What are the strong messages that we need to talk about, particularly to our youth, to educate them about HIV? What resonates? And I'm going to come to you first, Ashley.
And it's not to like scare the youth, but to say and to break it down simply that anybody can get HIV. HIV does not discriminate based on sex, religion, orientation, nothing. I knew of my status when I was 7. So I was able to grow up my entire life learning and self-educating myself, asking my doctor's questions. But then I also had other friends that didn't know their status until they were 14. And that's so dangerous. And the reason they didn't is because their parents were self-stigmatized themselves that they didn't want to share that information with their child. And that information can mean life or death. What, you don't think 14-year-olds are sexually active? It happens. It absolutely happens. I feel like a lot of people just want to pretend, you know, put on their blinders and like, it's not a real thing. So it's like, how do we fix that? Education.
Back when I was a resident in New York City, I had a research project I wanted to work on. And it was about talking to folks in Black churches about same gender love and homosexuality. And I remember Pernessa Seal, who I was meeting with from the Balm in Gilead, a faith-based organization, did a lot of work with churches back in the day. And I remember talking to her and I said, well, I want to talk to people and interview them about, you know, what they feel about same gender love and sex and stuff like that. And she said, honey, we can't even talk about sex between straight people, between heterosexuals. We don't even talk about it. So you have to crawl before you walk. And I still think about that now when we talk about LGBTQI plus interventions and kind of having these conversations. A lot of times heterosexual communities and just in sexual health in general, people don't want to talk about it on a general level. So we try to bring them even further to understand things that are out of their normal sphere.
I was thinking, young people know the impacts of high salt intake. They know the impacts of, you know, when you GMOs.
Vaping.
Yeah, vaping. Like, they know because we tell them that, you know, straight up, this causes that, period. But when we start to, when we start tiptoeing around sex and all that and not being straight up with people or having political agendas behind why we want folks to not have sex or whatever the case is, then that is what muddies the waters. And so just tell folks straight up. I tell my students all the time, I want you to have the best sex of your life every time you have it. And I want to show you how to have it in a healthy way.
We are not necessarily stigmatizing the disease as we're stigmatizing the act of, mm-hmm. right? You've talked about the effects you've had of stigma at a young age. Is there a story that you could share that highlights this stigma and really brings it to life?
There is one poignant moment for me in my life when I was 15, 16. I was doing a speaking tour, you know, really sharing my story. Right, like the day before a speech, you know, I was hanging out in a hotel room doing a radio interview. And then before I could even like get off the air, I was like checking my Twitter DMs and messages and all that stuff. And it was so hateful. And the people that it was coming from were parents, a mom of like three kids. And I just kept thinking to myself, oh my God, I feel bad for these children because they're going to grow up so hateful and ignorant. And people being like, you know, you are so gross for having HIV. Your birth mother, she's disgusting for having given it to you. And I think to myself, whoa, are you a human? Have you ever made a mistake before? And so I think there's just sometimes people lack such empathy. Like I said, I went back to it. Like, it could be you. So you better educate yourself and be kind.
Leslie, for you, when we think about stigma, how is that showing up in your students, particularly when they're thinking about PrEP, right? And this is pre-exposure prophylaxis. Yeah. So how does that stigma?
I didn't really face any, like, I guess, stigma that I could feel until I went to the doctor and wanted to get prescribed PrEP. And he was just so, like slut shaming. I mean, it wasn't affirming, and it wasn't, then he admittedly didn't know much about it or the impacts long term. And so the stigma that I faced was really in the healthcare industry. And students kind of share the same on the health centers on campus. Many of these health centers, unless you go to one of the larger institutions, these health centers are not equipped with 3 or 4 doctors and all this stuff. It's like a nurse practitioner up in there. Again, people are bringing their own stuff to work, and it is impacting students' ability to gain access or even have comfort to go and share some, you know, personal sexual, you know, things that they may have going on.
Yeah, and we know it's a great point because stigma really affects the sexual health conversation, which actually impacts whether people will go in to get HIV tested. Ashley, for you, what do you tell young people about why it's so important to get tested for HIV?
I always tell youth that it's so important because to know your status is sometimes it can be life or death. To not be educated, it can be life or death because you can be put in a situation and then be like, oh shit, what now? Mm-hmm. And what do I do now? And so I'm always trying to tell youth to advocate for their own health.
Why are stories such a powerful way to educate and inform people about HIV?
I think it all comes back to human connection. Now, a couple of days ago, I was in Washington, D.C., and I was speaking on Capitol Hill to Congress people. And we were basically just sharing our stories and them being like, please keep PEPFAR around because we really need it. We really do. But having these Congress people just being able to listen to us, giving us the space to have these conversations. And again, we're all human at the end of the day. So I feel like if we could share that vulnerability with others and be open and honest, then we're on track to be successful. I pray and I wish that more people were empathetic and more willing to have these sort of conversations. I mean, going back to stigma very quickly, growing up, I did a lot of speeches in schools, particularly one year, my little brother's kindergarten teacher had asked if I could speak in his school. Two separate speeches, 45 minutes each. One to the younger kids, like kindergarten to grade three, and then from grade three to grade eight. And obviously, you know, I'm talking about HIV. I'm not necessarily talking in full depth about sexual health to like a five-year-old, but, you know, keeping it pretty PG. And after that one speech, I had the principal come up to me and be like, great speech, thank you for coming. But in your next talk, when the other students come in, can you not mention HIV? I'm still speechless thinking about it. Like, this was in my hometown of like 110,000 people in the small suburb of Ontario, Canada, being told, hey, like, you brought me in to speak about HIV, but you don't want me to talk about HIV.
And Leslie, for you, especially working with a lot of college-age students, why are stories so important?
Yeah, I think it connects us to a shared humanity. And so, that, you know, that's like the Obama approach. Like, everybody can feel what it's like to be pushed away or cast away, whether it be HIV or drug addiction or whatever the case is, right? Like, we all can think of a time where we have felt marginalized or stigmatized for something that we did.
You evoked former President Barack Obama, and what he was very much known for was hope. That was his platform. And what I would love to know from you both is, where's the hope in your advocacy work? And Leslie, I'll start with you and come to you, Asha. Yeah. But where's the hope in the advocacy work?
The hope is with the young people. I love the fact, I mentioned that high schooler that told me about pansexual. I love that he knew what that was. I love that these gender issues or whatever the identities are not a thing for these young people. They give me hope. Having the first Gen Z elected to Congress gives me hope. And so that is where I'm kind of like sitting at. Like, you know, I'm waiting for, you know, our parents and grandparents to retire. But it's time for us to bring, you know, a new generation. In 1950s, there were a thing. It's 2023 and there's a new thing.
Right.
And so it's important for us to usher in leadership for a country that we want to realize and not for a country that was of past times. There are young people that do things that I would never do when I was in college, shutting down the president's office and, you know, blocking traffic and stuff because they are unapologetic about what they need and require. That gives me hope that they are willing to put their bodies on the line to realize a world that they that is inclusive and that they want to live in.
Ashley, what about you? What does hope look like in advocacy for you?
I think very similarly, the hope can be found in the youth. The younger we are having these conversations, the more impactful, because, I mean, we're going to be the leaders of tomorrow. So we need to start acting today and getting it right and being unapologetic, like you said. And I mean, I had a shirt years ago that said unapologetically HIV positive. And I'm unapologetically HIV positive, and I have to be, or else, like, I'm going to have people silence me. No matter what you're going through, that you can overcome it, because you are you. You are unapologetically you, and keep doing what you're doing because it is working.
And could I just also just say one more thing? Because I am a person of faith. And so, you know, I also want to say, if we don't have hope, then what's the alternative? You know, like, I would hate to see a group, a population of people without hope. And so I have hope, honestly, to keep just waking up every day and working towards a better, you know, future. Martin Luther King said, the moral arc of the universe is long, but it always bends towards justice. And so we have to believe that.
One last question for both of you before we close. And I'll start with you, Ashley. What does the end of the HIV epidemic look like to you?
I don't think I've ever been asked that before. What does it look like to me? I'd say in one word, it looks achievable. In Congress the other day, like, we're talking about, like, you know, 2030, we're going to end HIV in 2030. And how do we do that? We work together. We just have to be true to who we are, true to our mission, and we will be unstoppable. But as long as you believe in yourself, that's all the power you need.
All right, Leslie, what about you? What does the end of the HIV epidemic look like to you?
It looks like access. And, you know, I'm going to keep it there. Folks need access.
Amen.
To life-saving drugs and preventative stuff.
I want to thank both of you for joining us today. It's been very inspirational to hear both of your stories and about the continued work that both of you do, particularly with our youth and how we can end this for the future. And we're looking at an AIDS-free or an HIV-free generation in the future. So thank you all for coming again. Today's guests prove that if young people are the leaders of tomorrow, we're in good hands. They're bringing their passion and expertise to inspire others to action. Right now, the story of HIV has a beginning and it has a middle. And with the help of the younger generation, we can write an ending that turns decades of tragedy into one of the greatest triumphs this world has ever seen. How's that for happily ever after?
If you've liked what you heard today, subscribe to Zero Hour wherever you get your podcasts and look for it on YouTube. And for more information, please visit GileadHIVTogether.com. This presentation is protected by U.S. and international copyright laws and owned by Gilead Sciences. The podcast should not be copied, reproduced, or distributed in whole or in part without express permission from Gilead Sciences. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gilead Sciences.